I'm just trying to speak a little bit louder tonight because one of us has a problem with hearing. So I thought what I would start with is some descriptions of how the world is constructed. And as an example, I want to tell you about a friend of mine who has a condition called anosmia. Now, anosmia is the inability to smell. So this has resulted in his inability to taste. Food just tastes completely flat. He's actually kind of skinny and doesn't take particular pleasure in eating because there's really no subtlety there. So he feels that food doesn't have flavor. Now, you have to wonder, well, I mean, his tongue is working, so shouldn't he be able to taste? But as it turns out, that seems not to be much. There are five basic tastes that the tongue is capable of. It can taste sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and a fifth taste that was discovered maybe 15 years ago or 20 years ago called deliciousness or savoriness. So those five tastes, one would think, would be sufficient in mixture to be able to taste flavor. But in fact, it isn't. So, for example, when we eat a blueberry, we don't say, oh, let's see, there's some sweetness and a little bit of sour, and that's a blueberry. No. A blueberry depends upon the sense of smell, which is actually extremely intricate. There are something like 10,000 individual smells that we believe that humans can smell, and dogs may be able to smell quite a bit more than that. So it's something about the combination of the taste of the food on your tongue, its consistency in your mouth, which is a feeling, sense of feeling, and the odor of the food as it wafts up into the part of your upper nose called the cribriform plate, where there are actual olfactory nerves that pick up chemicals. And that whole thing comes together and you say blueberry. So in this way, we construct the flavor of a blueberry, and it happens instantly, automatically. The more we taste it, the more we seem to recognize it. It becomes very, very automatic. And yet we don't realize that there's a critical part that is the greatly subtle part that takes something very basic, which we call taste, and makes flavor. So to give you another example of this, they've done research into emotion. Now, there are not as many emotions as there are smells, but there are a lot of different emotions. So we can all relate to the emotion of sadness, fear, anger, rage, lust, pity. There's a lot of different emotions, jealousy. So some researchers have looked into the matter of feelings, these emotions and feelings. Like, what are they actually? Because there are emotions felt in certain cultures that are not at all felt in other cultures. They have names for these emotions, and we wouldn't know what that emotion is. So what these researchers looked into, and this is kind of a Buddhistic approach to emotion, is they broke it down. So there's something happening, there's a sensory aspect to emotion, And they came up with this, and it sounds very similar to a practice done in Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana practice. The four basic palpable, almost tactile feelings of any emotion are pleasant, unpleasant, activating, or excitement related, and calming. So there's either pleasurable, unpleasurable, activated, or calm. And there are various admixtures of those that are found in each of the emotions. But they alone, just like the tastes on your tongue, the five tastes on your tongue, are not enough to make an emotion. So they did research to find out what is it that makes the emotion, for example, pity. It's some combination of those four basic factors plus a thought process, an association with past memories, with what we've been taught and learned, stories we've experienced, personal experiences. All these things go into this vast storehouse of conceptualization, which then we really truly can say is as intricate or more intricate than the olfactory sense, the sense of smell, which can pick up 10,000 different smells. So something very automatic happens. In other words, we perceive an event and then we feel an emotion. The emotion is those four basic sensations and what the event triggers in the mind, what it triggers, the reactions that it triggers. And some of those reactions are learned in some cultures and not at all learned in other cultures. It's almost like the Eskimos having 50 different kinds of snow, and we basically have snow, slush, and sleet, and that's about it. So, this practice of Zazen is a process of breaking down automaticities that structure a world which seems to be outside of us, has rules we take for granted, needs to be improved in some way, has to have something held onto and something else rejected. And this very complex interplay of sensations, sight, smell, taste, touch, and what are the others? Hearing and thinking all come together to create what we call reality, what we call reality. Actually, it's not considered reality from the standpoint of Buddhism. It's a construct. One might call it a delusion or an illusion. So when we come to this practice, both as beginners and as longtime practitioners who have been immersed in worldly affairs and now sit on the cushion, we have to learn a different way of experiencing the moment-by-moment sensations of our life. The way that we learn this through Zazen is called mindfulness, and there's also an inquiry aspect to it, a sort of a penetrating, questioning aspect to it. But we come initially with a freight train that has a lot of momentum. It's been careening down the track for many years. In Buddhism, they say lifetimes of grasping, conceptualizing, making ideas more important almost than the sensations we feel, and structuring our entire world around that, then feeling that there's something lacking. We need to improve ourselves. So Zazen has to be a way of improving ourselves, changing something. Something isn't right, I've got to change it. All of these things. So we have to bring a very different attitude to this practice in order to liberate ourselves from the entrapment in these very automatic constructions. So as Richard Clark used to say, our minds are in the construction business. They construct reality out of lots of disparate individual parts. In Buddhism, they might be called skandhas. And they're assembled together to make a concatenation which we call this particular reality. So how do we do that? I thought what I would do in order to elaborate a little bit more on that is read to you from a wonderful Chan master, Su Yun. So Su Yun died in, I believe, 1959. He died at the age of 119. He was a very famous and wonderful and great Zen master in China, maybe one of the last real living Buddhas on earth, at least to this point in time. So he goes into this habit pattern of creating a universe out of our reactions, our concepts, our learned, taught emotions, and how it hangs us up. So he talks in terms of the person beginning Zazen. Now I'm going to include people who have never done Zazen before, and people who have been immersed in their life and then sit on the cushion, in a sense at that moment, coming from this world of spinning around, grasping at this and rejecting that, and trying to make this line up in a row, and trying to make something better than it is, to doing Zazen. And in a sense, at that moment, you're a beginner. So, he says here, the most common defects of a beginner lie in his, and this is also hers, but it's translated his, so I'll say that, his and her inability to lay down his habits of false thinking. So everything I've described so far, in terms of this practice of mindfulness, where we break things down, we get very, very simple, is a kind of false thinking, meaning it's arbitrary, it's subjective, and it has no permanent universal truth to it. So in this sense, he calls it false thinking. Most common defect is the inability to lay down habits of false thinking, of self-indulgence in ignorance caused by pride and jealousy, of self-inflicted obstructions caused by concupiscence, anger, stupidity, and love, of laziness and gluttony, and of attachment to right and wrong, to selfness and otherness. With a belly filled with all the above defects, this is in parentheses, I don't think he used that word, how can this person be responsive to the truth? And so he talks about this, about the kleshas, about the way of living our lives in this realm of false thinking, taking it deadly seriously, and often feeling that things aren't going our way, that we're coming up short, that someone has wronged us, that there's something more, we don't know what it is, and it creates this whole set of emotions called kleshas in Buddhism. Kleshas are what I guess Freud would call the neuroses. It's anxieties, worries, concerns, habits of whatever, addictions, self-hatred, all these different things. So he goes on now and talks about that's what is difficult for the beginner, because we come from this mechanism that is just running on its own, it's on automatic. What is the easiness? So this is the critical thing, and this really speaks to what we're doing here on the cushion. So he says, easiness for beginners, laying down of the burden of thinking and giving rise to a single thought. And this is Most people doing Zazen for the first time say that's extremely difficult, but it's actually easy when you know how to do it. So he says, that Suyun is now saying, although the training seems difficult, it becomes very easy once its method is known. Where does easiness lie for beginners? There is nothing ingenious in it because it lies in, and this is in quotes, laying down. Laying down what? The burden of distress, and in parentheses, klesha, that's the Buddhist term for this emotional distress. Laying down the burden of distress caused by ignorance. Laying it down. Putting it down. How does one lay it down? You've all been at the bedside of a dead man. If you try to scold him a few times, he will not be excited. If you give him a few strokes of the staff, he will not strike back. Formerly, he indulged in ignorance, but now he cannot do so anymore. Formerly, he longed for reputation and wealth, but now he no longer wants it. Formerly, he was contaminated by habits, but now he is free of them. Now he does not make distinctions and lays down everything. Dear friends, please look at all this. When we have breathed our last, this physical body of ours will become a corpse. Because we cherish this body, we are unable to lay down everything, with the resultant creation of self and other, right and wrong, like and dislike, acceptance and rejection. If we only regard this body as a corpse, we will not cherish it, and will certainly not consider it as ours. If so, is there anything we cannot lay down? And he goes on and he says here, we only have to lay down everything, day and night, no matter whether we walk, stand, sit, or recline, in the midst of either stillness or disturbance, and whether busy or not, throughout our bodies, within and without, there should only be a doubt, a uniform, harmonizing, and continuous doubt, unmixed with any other thoughts. In other words, a Wato. So he goes into this koan practice. So he's talking to people that are in a retreat and can utterly lay down everything. And if you do find yourself lucky enough to attend a sesshin, there's one coming up at the end of July, you'll be in a very safe place where you can actually do that, lay down everything and just pick up one thought. But we need to be able to do that when we sit down on our cushion. We need to be able to lay it down. Now, how do we lay it down? How is that done? First of all, we watch. We watch very closely. We observe. In other words, we go backwards from the world that's constructed by lots of smells and five basic tastes, tons of different thought concepts, and four different feelings. We slow it down and see it, see the actual sensations of what we thought were solid outside realities. So one way that I've put it is, you obviously pick up your practice, if it's counting the breath, following the breath, doing the koan, shikantaza, you pick it up and you hold it. And then you immediately notice that there's a lot going on. There's sounds, there's thinking, and then the thinking creates a reaction. The reaction creates an emotion. The emotion creates a sense of grasping or rejecting, wanting to change something, and we're lost again in this momentum that we brought to the cushion from our everyday life that we learned for years and lifetimes. So we need to take that burden, what he calls this burden of suffering or kleshas, and simply observe their sensation. Just observe their sensation. What does it actually feel like? You might say when you're tasting the blueberry, you're no longer saying blueberry, you're just recognizing the smell and the sourness and the sweetness. We start to simplify. So we just observe. And in doing that, we bring ourselves back to the actual practice. So what was sticky before, because we were constructing a reality, we're now deconstructing. We're bringing it back to its actual component parts, its skandhas, so to speak, its essential parts. So remember, the Buddha said, all component things are subject to decay, meaning everything in the universe that can be seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, known, conceptualized, planets, galaxies, suns, subatomic particles. He said, all component things are subject to decay. All things are components. And when we sit down with this attitude of mind, we begin to see the components of what seemed like a very solid outside world. So the first step is to observe the sensation. Just observe it. And also recognize that at the moment the sensation has occurred, it's occurred, it's done. You can't go back and change that. And each moment is exactly like that. You don't know what's coming, but by the time you sense it, be it a thought, an emotion, a feeling, anything, a sound in the room, feeling a coolness on your skin, it is utterly and completely done. This is the beginning of putting down the burden. If it's done, you don't need to react to it. If it's done, you can't hold on to it. If it's done, you can't make it go away. It can just be exactly what it is. And then we come back to our practice. So we do this repeatedly. We get caught by thoughts. They pull us around a little bit. And we notice that we're in the thought. Our practice is fading as we get caught in this emotional maelstrom oftentimes. And we first notice its sensation. We don't say, damn it, I'm thinking again. We don't do battle with it. We don't try to think it away. We don't try to counterbalance it with some positive thought or positive emotion. That's not the method of Zazen. The method of Zazen is to go back to the essential components, bring it back to the components, the sensation. Now, as a sensation, any thought, any emotion, any reality in your mind doing Zazen is equal. Neither better nor worse. It's not better or worse than the count. One, two. It's not better or worse than mu. It's just various sensations that because of causes and effects, because of karmic conditions, came to fruition at that moment, came into the awareness of the sitter, and therefore are completely and utterly done and cannot be gotten rid of, cannot be held on to. They're completely done. As a result of this, we develop an important ingredient of Zazen. Now, you've heard the four vows. Four noble truths. That life is suffering, and suffering comes from desire. Those are the first two of the four noble truths. The end of desire brings the end of suffering. Now, what is this desire? It is the impulse to change what is, to get rid of it, hold on to it, get more of it, compare it to something else. So we see this going on in our Zazen. If we get very particular about this word desire, it's a movement away or towards clinging to something. The letting go of desire is what one could call dispassion, dispassion. So part of the essential starting point when we sit down on our cushion as beginners in Zazen is to develop this mind of dispassion. Now, dispassionate mind is very acute, notices everything, doesn't ignore. It doesn't not care. It doesn't just let it go because it's inconsequential. It sees very clearly the sensation, but it also knows that the sensation is complete, that it could not have been any other way because we live in a karmic universe of cause and effect. Therefore, when it appeared in my mind, it was done and complete. It has its reasons. I don't need to know them. And that is dispassion. From this dispassionate place, we then funnel our attentiveness. away from all the things pulling us one way and another, which we have begun to disentangle from through this dispassionate approach, and we bring it into one thing. So this is what Su Yun said. It's laying down the burden of distress and picking up the one thought. So we pick up this one thought. What does it mean to pick up one thought? It means to enter the sensation of one thought. What is that one thought? It's one, two, three. How does that help us? Because what we focus on in Zazen is neutral. There's no grabbing at it. There's no rejecting it. We practice simply observing its sensation, moment after moment after moment. And if something begins to intrude on this dispassionate noticing moment after moment of a sensation, be it the sensation of breathing, the count, a koan or shikantaza, whatever it might be, if anything intrudes, we treat it just like we treat the count, or just like we treat the sensation of breath. It's another sensation, and we simply observe it and understand that it's completely done in each moment. This is entering this Zazen, which is a kind of mindfulness. This is the essential aspect of mindfulness. So, the best way to learn this is not by hearing someone talk about it, but by actually doing it. I think it is helpful to get pointers, but you basically have to plunge into it yourself. You have to walk the walk, not just hear about it. But I will stop right now and ask if anyone has any comments or questions about what I just said, or any things that seem to trip them up and they can't be dispassionate about, and how might you let go of any particular thing. Anyone have anything that seems to block them in their Zazen? One of the greatest blocks is coming to this practice with a sense of lacking, a sense that the practice is going to give you something that you don't already have. And then you are actually doing with your practice what you're doing at other times in your life, which is applying complex concepts about yourself and ideas about what Zazen can accomplish, and checking to see if it's actually happening, and using it as a tool to change something, rather than entering this dispassionate space of observation, noticing sensation, noticing the presence of sensation, and noticing that that's intimate. That's a different direction than using Zazen to make yourself better. Does anyone have anything they want to say? Well, actually, we've reached the end of our time, so let's end here.